House Committee on Revenue for March 12, 2015 will come to order. We'll open the information meeting, update on senior property tax deferral program. Kyle.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So we do have a bill up today a little bit later related to senior deferral, but we thought we would ask the Department of Revenue to come up and give a little background on the program and update on where we are and kind of where we're headed with their core system replacement as well.
Great. Which we assume is germane to the presentation.
Yes, I should say the core system replacement in how it regards to the senior deferral program.
Thank
only.
You. Yeah, yes. I assume that's what yes. you meant. Right. Yes. So, welcome. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Today, we were asked to come and present for you a little background on the senior deferral program. I've brought with me today Bronson Rueda, who manages that program for the Department of Revenue. I'm basically here to run the PowerPoint for now. So,
great.
I will turn it over to Bronson.
That must be a relief.
Indeed.
All right, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Bronson Rueda, and I am the unit manager for the deferral program at the Department of Revenue. I'm here today to give a very brief and high-level overview of the program and some historical information, and then towards the tail end, a little about the financial health of the program itself. So, a lot of people ask, what is deferral? Quite simply, the deferral program is designed to give the seniors and qualified disabled people of Oregon a chance to defer their taxes until they disqualify from the program. And the way the Department of Revenue receives that money back is by placing a lien on the participant's home. And when they're disqualified, then those monies are repaid back to the program. One item that the participants have to do is recertify every 2 years. And it's through that recertification process that we are able to identify if anyone no longer meets the requirements of the program. And if they don't meet the requirements, then they disqualify. And there are four ways in which you can disqualify from the program. One is if you pass away. Taxpayer passes away, and then another is if the property is sold, and it's not just a market transaction, but if they transfer the property, then it also qualifies as being disqualified. And in addition, if they move from the property for reasons other than health, then that triggers disqualification. And then finally, if it is a manufactured structure or building home, and they move out of the state, they move that structure out of the state, then that also triggers disqualification. The program started in 1963, and it was designed to be a self-sustaining program. The money's coming in to the program were designed to then fund future deferrals for current participants and future participants. For many years, for a little over 45 years, the program was going along smoothly. And then in 2006, $250,000 was, not to say that wasn't smooth, but in 2006, $250,000 was transferred to Oregon Project Independence, OPI. And then in 2008, again, a much larger sum was transferred to OPI, approximately $14.3 million. Around that same time, shortly after that transfer, the downturn of the economy that started in late 2007, early 2008, was finally hitting the residential real estate market in Oregon. And it was revealed through forecasting that the deferral program could no longer be self-sustaining going along the same course. And some of the factors that contributed to that were a drop in home values, a decline in home sales that ultimately reduced the cash flow of the program. And with the reduction of cash flow coming out of the program, there was an increase of cash flow going out of the program with increased participation. So because of this downturn in the economy, the deferral program had to delay payment to the counties in 2010. Typically, November 15th is when we make the bulk of our payments to the counties. And in 2010, we could no longer do that year. So we had to make a partial payment to the counties in 2010. And then in May of 2011, we had to pay the rest of the balance. And at that point, the account had a zero balance. Senate Bill 939 in 2011 pumped more life back into the program. We were loaned $19 million. And then at the same time, you passed House Bill 2543 that made some major structural changes to the program. So before I get into what changed due to House Bill 2543, I think it's important to note that pre-House Bill 2543, there are essentially a couple of requirements to be in the program. And that is an income requirement and then also an age requirement. Unless you had a qualified disability, then you could be of any age to get into the program. After House Bill 2543 passed, there are now multiple new requirements and some change requirements. Some of the ones that are highlighted is the income changed to a household income. So if you had one participant in the program but three people living in the home that had income, then you had to count all of that income towards program participation. There was also an RMV limitation, and that is directly tied to the county median. You had to have proof of insurance. You had to have a five-year residency requirement. You could no longer have a reverse mortgage. And then a $500,000 household asset limitation was placed. Other major changes in the program include the need to recertify. And we have people recertify every 2 years. And how that works is if the main participant's Social Security number ends in an even number, then they recertify every even year. If it ends in an odd number, then they recertify every odd year. And then the interest, which is accrued on everybody's account, was changed from simple interest to compound interest. That was also in 2011. Some of the effects from House Bill 2543 included a drop in program participation. So it went down approximately 31%, and it upset many taxpayers. I think some of you may have received some calls, as did the Department of Revenue, to the tune of thousands, too many to keep track of, but we had many calls and took us many months to attend to those phone calls. In 2012, due to demand, there was another legislative change, House Bill 4039. And the biggest highlight from House Bill 4039 was those that were inactivated due to having a reverse mortgage could now come back in on a short-term basis, a two-year period, if they were solely inactivated due to having a reverse mortgage and they had sent in a recertification by February 1st. And that affected approximately 1,500 people that were allowed to come back in on that two-year reprieve. Then in 2013, we had two more legislative changes, House Bill 2489 and House Bill 2510. I'll cover House Bill 2489 first. House Bill 2489, essentially from the year prior, it extended those, that cohort that had their two-year reprieve into perpetuity. So if they had a reverse mortgage, they could just keep on staying in the program if they met all the other requirements. House Bill 2510. This one was, on the face of it, it's a little confusing, but once you wrap your head around it, you can get it. But essentially, it allows participants who were inactivated in 2011 solely due to having a reverse mortgage or not meeting the five-year residency requirement or both to participate again starting in January 1st of 2014. It's important to note that they didn't just automatically get to be back in the program. They had to actually get the application, fill it out, and resubmit it as if they were a new applicant. And we anticipated, there was approximately 2,200 people that could have reapplied. And out of those 2,200 people, 157 actually reapplied and were admitted back into the program. But we limited the amount to 700 people because we just simply didn't know how many people were going to reapply. If we had all 2,200 come back in, well, then that increased cash flow out when it came time to make those payments. We may not have had the funds in the revolving account in order to make that payment. So we limited, well, you limited that to 700. But we didn't anywhere near reach that. As I said before, we only had 157 participants come back into the program under House Bill 2510.
Excuse me, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks very much for your presentation. Was there a notification of any sort sent by the department or the counties to residents who may have been disqualified about the ability to jump back in under 2510? Do you know what the communication was?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Davis. There was a notification. We identified the approximately 2,200 people, and we sent out notification regarding House Bill 2510 and let them know they would have an opportunity starting on January 1st, 2014 to apply back into the program.
Yes, Representative Vega Peters.
Thank you, Chair. And I know that some of the advocacy groups working on this also reached out to their membership to let them know about them as well.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I want to thank Representative Vega Peterson for her work on this bill, and I think it was this one that you kind of headed up. And I know we communicated with thousands of constituents because I have a number who are on this program, so I'm just astonished. I'm absolutely astonished that only 157 jumped back on. Either perhaps we were a little too tight with the bill, or which is a good and has pros and cons, or I don't know. That's just astonishing to me.
Yes, Representative, what's it, please?
Since I'm not hugely familiar with it, could you explain on the reverse mortgages, who gets the money first if, say, the person passes away or whatever? Is it the state or the reverse mortgage company? How do you figure out when the state is owed money back and the reverse mortgage company holds the mortgage on it?
Before they answer, let me just comment that You hit on the crux of the reason why we put the reverse mortgage disqualifier in the original bill.
Right, and now it's back, though, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah.
Do you want to answer it, or shall I?
If you're volunteering, Representative Barnhart.
The answer is that the banks were very, very unhappy about the possibility of being put in second place to another creditor. And so we didn't do that. What we did instead was simply say, if you have a reverse mortgage, you don't qualify for essentially reverse mortgage as well under the original bill.
Right. Now what do we do?
Then that's a good question for him.
The
question was, now what do we do?
Well, before I answer that, Representative Barnhart, Representative Woodsett, one other thing I might add is that with the reverse mortgage and I am not a loan officer. I don't have extensive experience with reverse mortgages, so I'll make that statement right now. But typically, it's my understanding that with a reverse mortgage, you have far less equity in the property than you would have with a traditional mortgage. So typically, mortgage companies will not loan on a house unless they're in first position. Mm-hmm. So reverse mortgage will be in first position, which would make the deferral program in second position. And so if you have no equity, when somebody disqualifies, then they have no ability to pay their account back, which means we are not paid back, which negatively impacts the program.
So, please.
May I follow up? So have you projected out on all the people that are in there what this is going to look like when they can't pay it back? I mean, have you looked ahead to see, oh, this many reverse mortgages are out there that probably we're not going to be able to collect anything back to the state on the deferral?
Do you get to that point later in your presentation?
Not exactly.
Not exactly. Okay.
So, Representative Barnhart, Representative Woodsett, we don't have the capability of tracking all the reverse mortgages. We don't have the capability of tracking what their account balances are on their mortgage. We don't have that information. So we have no way to determine, to forecast whose balance is going to be where at what point in time, because we simply don't have that information.
Okay, we'll follow up on that then. What's your experience been on situations where it was time to recover, and there wasn't sufficient equity in the helm for you to make a full recovery. Right. How often does that happen, and is it any of it as a result of reverse mortgages?
Representative Barnhart, I have a slide at the very end that
Thank
covers
you. Thank
some,
you.
Some
we'll
of
get
that
to
information.
That. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. So that brings us to last year, 2014. There was, again, another bill passed, and that was House Bill 4148, and that reverted the compound interest change back in 2011 back to simple interest at some point in 2016, mid-2016 or so. And then this year, we have more activity, as you can see here at the legislature, and in the midst of that, we are also going through rollout 2 for the core systems replacement, CSR, at Department of Revenue. So we are at the beginning stages right now. We don't know what changes we're going to make exactly to the program. We don't know what efficiencies will be gained at this time, but we are very optimistic that we will have efficiencies in the administration of the program. But at this point, we just don't know what yet as we're going through the process.
Yes, Representative Woodson.
I'm sorry to keep asking, but I'm just not familiar with this. So does the state deferral exclude local bonds, et cetera? When you're deferring property tax, you only defer the state?
Let's have him explain what the department does and how it deals with property tax, because that we went by that really fast.
Okay.
And I think she has it wrong, but why don't you tell us, for all the new members, what you actually do when you get a tax bill.
Okay. So Representative Barnhart, Chair Barnhart, Representative Woodsit, what we do is we collect a lot of information from somebody who applies for the deferral program. One piece of that information is the property tax bill. And we don't dissect or look heavily into all the different taxing entities of that property tax bill. We just look at the total, and then we look at what's the 3% off of that, and that's what we defer. We defer the total minus 3%.
No, actually, you're not deferring anything, are you? You're actually paying that tax.
Correct.
Aren't you?
Yes, we're the taxpayer gets that deferred, and then we pay that amount to the county in which they reside.
So the state is paying the tax, and then adding it back to an obligation of the owner or of the property to repay it. Yes?
Correct.
And that's the deferral part.
Correct.
Right. So if I may, so for example, in Klamath County, you might have a home that's, say, $250,000 that has a $1,400 a year tax payment. Come up here to Salem, the same house is close to $6,000, depending where you're at in the town, you know, in the city. So if a person applies, it's the full amount then? I mean, an elderly person with a home valued at, say, $250,000, because mm-hmm. same thing, Josephine County or Curry County is going to be really low, and then Lake Oswego or Salem or, you know, whatever, they're carrying huge bonds for their schools and things like that, and police or whatever, that we don't have in some other parts of the state. So I'm just trying to understand, you just pay the total tax bill that comes due for those people, no matter where they live.
Correct. As long as they qualify to be in the right. program, the okay. amount of their taxes is not part of that criteria to determine whether they're eligible or not eligible.
Okay.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Okay, the next five slides are going to deal with some of the financial health of the deferral program. If you have any questions, please jump in there.
And what, before he goes ahead and talks about this, let me just take a minute to talk about the problem that we faced as a result of the recession. He's already pointed out that the revolving account was broke. They were unable to make the payments in, was it 2010? I forget the exact year. And this committee was faced with either closing the program altogether or figuring out some way or another to keep it open and borrowing some money from the Treasury to tide us over. And then the other things that happened after that were further adjustments in the decisions that we made at that time to try to save the program. So the thing gets pretty complicated pretty fast if you think about this as sort of something you would have invented. But we weren't inventing. What we were trying to do was save a program that had been around for 30-some-odd years and had worked pretty well in the past, but all of a sudden it wasn't working at all anymore. So that's sort of the background. So now he's going to talk about the revolving account, and if some of us get really beady-eyed about this item, it's because this is the place that prompted everything else that we did. Please, go ahead.
Can I ask
you? Oh, yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because it's specifically, I jotted down, so in 2006 and 2008, those transfers, were they just because we had a lot of extra money in that account, and so we transferred them to OPI, or was it for some other reason?
That was a Ways and Means decision. You didn't know you were doing it, but you were asking a political question.
Oh. Good to know.
And it isn't fair to ask them to comment on that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I assume, Chair Barnhart, that means I'm off the hook for that question.
Yes.
Okay, back to the PowerPoint. up there I have the revolving account balances dating back from December 2011 and then projected to December 2017. I do want to point out there is an error, and that is the vertical line should be one column to the left. So the first three columns have happened. The last three columns are projected.
Ah, okay.
Okay. If you glance at this chart, and you look at...
Excuse me, just a moment. Jessica, Representative Vega-Peterson, please.
Thank you, Chair. Just understanding that it's one over, how when we were looking at some of the legislation that we did in the past sessions, how have the actuals matched up with what was projected for some of those, for the program?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vega-Peterson, I haven't done that analysis, uh-huh. So if that's something that you guys would like to see, we can certainly put that together and send it to you.
Okay, thank you.
To see how the projections match up with the actuality.
That would be very useful, don't you think?
Yes.
Representative Davis?
Thanks. At least my expectation was that we were going to hit up to that 700 getting back in the program relatively quickly. So I imagine it's the projections are going to be higher since we've only been at 154 or whatever who come back in. But.
Well, of course, this is a moving target, too. You're taking new applications all the time, aren't you?
New applications are accepted from January 2nd to April 15th each year.
So right now you're taking them?
Correct.
Right.
And I will point out that forecasting is very difficult to do when the game changes every year. So because there's been changes for the past 4 years, it's very difficult to forecast any sort of... level line when it keeps changing.
Thank you. That's it. The committee, as you could hear, got the message.
So if you look at the chart, it shows that on the bottom line, the December 1st balance was $22 million, and then over time it went down, and it's projected to steadily increase over time, which is good. That's a good sign. That the financial health into the future on this chart is as well. One thing that I do want to point out, though, is on the second line, the repayments line, those have steadily gone down on an average. And into the future, it's projected that they continue to go down. So that's a trend on both of those accounts. The trend is that payments going out are increasing, but repayments coming in are decreasing. If that trend continues, at some point those lines will intersect. Hard to forecast when, but if they do intersect, then that means the balance of the revolving account will start to go down instead of going up like it's projected here.
And just to speculate, that roughly fits with the demographic changes that we see in the population age, doesn't it? I mean, it occurs to me that the baby boom generation is moving into the age when this kind of application makes sense to them, and they're a very large group as compared to the people whose homes are coming onto the market and from which are being repaid.
Representative Chair Barnhart, that could be a correlation there, although we haven't done that analysis.
Great. Thank you.
On the next page is a graph that essentially visually gives you the same information. The dotted line is the revolving account balance, the amount of money that's in the account available to pay the tax payments in November. So projected, it is going up. The blue solid line are the tax payments going out. As you can see, it's steadily increasing over time, a projected increase. And the red line are the repayments coming into the program. And as you can see,
green.
Excuse me, I'm colorblind. So the green, solid green line is repayments coming back in. And as you can see visually, those two lines are getting closer together. I have received one question already about what was used for the forecasting, what information was used for the forecasting. We had our economist, an economist at Department of Revenue, put together this information, and our initial forecast was much more glum than this. It had the lines intersecting around 2018, I believe, and I think some of you may have seen that. That was an aggressive forecast, and since then we have looked at it in a couple different ways, in a non-aggressive forecast, and what you see here is kind of somewhere in the middle. So it's not too aggressive, not too conservative, but somewhere in the middle.
So to answer the political question that nobody asked, we better make sure that nobody grabs any of this money, because that makes those lines cross a lot faster.
Representative Chair Barnhart, that's your decision, I think.
Yes, thank you. You see the point I was making, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Please go ahead.
Okay. Next slide has to do with how many accounts we have where we can expect to, or that still owe money in some regard. The first column are active accounts, ones that we're still paying their taxes every year, except for the, let me start over. The active column are the accounts that we are paying every November. The inactive column is the column that they have a balance, it's still accruing interest, but we are not paying on their account every year. They've gone inactive for whatever reason. They haven't met some of the criteria, so they're inactive. Disqualified are those that we're no longer paying on their account, and we will be collecting that balance hopefully within the next, by April 15th of this year, or excuse me, August 15th of this year, or August 15th of next year, depending on when these are disqualified. And the canceled accounts are those people that were active, but they voluntarily withdrew from the program. They still have an active balance that's accumulating interest, but they voluntarily do not want to participate in the program any further. Hmm. And we'll collect that money whenever they disqualify.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the risk of inadvertently asking another political question, mm-hmm. Could you explain just right next to each other again the difference between inactive and disqualified as far as who's paying what, and okay. Both on the state side and on the recipient side?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, the inactive cohort are those that obviously used to be active, but now they no longer meet their criteria to stay active. So we are no longer going to be paying, as of now, we're no longer going to be paying their property tax every year in November, but they still have a balance, and that balance is continuing to accrue interest.
A balance that they owe us.
A balance that they owe the program.
Yes. Okay.
And then the disqualified cohort are those that have met one of the four disqualified criteria that I mentioned before. Either they passed away, they sold their house, title transferred. So they are now, as of August 15th, their balance is due of this year or August 15th of next year, depending on when that disqualification happened.
Okay.
So we can expect bottom line is, of the disqualified cohort, we can expect to collect their money within the next year and 3-4 months.
But not such so with the inactive.
No. That will continue to sit there until they can voluntarily pay it off at any time, or until they disqualify.
Just to follow up on it, do we have an idea why these 1,300 accounts became inactive? I mean, it occurs to me that one of the reasons, for example, might be that their home was worth more than the average real market value in the county, and that would disqualify them. There are probably other reasons why they might have disqualified as well. Do you have that information, or is that something you'd have to go dig for?
Chair Barnhart, that's something that we would have to go dig for.
Okay.
If you want us to, we can certainly dig and get that.
But I guess the point I'm making is that some of these people probably became inactive because under that first bill we passed, they simply no longer qualify. One of the properties that we heard about at that time was a property worth a great deal of money, and for which we paid a lot of taxes. And because we established this median real market value rule, it no longer qualified. And so that one became inactive.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody done anything wrong.
Right.
We just simply changed the rules for how you get on the program.
Okay. But those cases would just be, we're just kind of floating them alone, not an interest tree because they're still probably accumulating an interest, but we do not yet have a payoff date. Is that
correct?
Accurate?
Correct. That's accurate.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Representative Whitsitt.
Do you know how many of those in the disqualified, for example, are in a probate? That are deceased, and you probably have a lag time of a year or two to get those estates settled so that you can get your money from the sale, I would assume, of those 2 to 3 years or something, a lag time?
We don't have that information.
Yeah, thank you. Please go ahead. Yeah.
I'm going to move on to the next slide unless there's further questions on this one. This slide is labeled total liabilities, and please note that these are all as of November 17th of 2014 when this data was compiled. So what this information tells you is that if you look at the second row, the total liability, $153 million. Out of all of the cohorts that we have, the inactive, active, disqualified, and canceled, that's how much is owed. That's how much is on the balance for the deferral program. That's not how much is owed right now. That's just how much at some point we should be collecting, barring any canceled debts.
Okay.
And the last slide, speaking of canceled debt, what you want to look at here, if you just want one number, is on the total column, second from the left, all the way down to the totals number, $2.346 million. That is the total number of money that was owed to us that we simply didn't collect over a course of the last 5 years. So roughly $500,000 a year.
Okay. Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, while you first look at that and that's a big number, compared to the overall account balances, it seems not, do you know a percentage? Like, do you have is that a 5% canceled debt ratio, you know, percentage? Is it 50, you know?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, I don't have a percentage, but it is a nominal amount when you put it in. $500,000 a year, we pay out, this last year we paid out to the counties $14 million. So that is a small number, and then we collect approximately $1.9 million a month. So that is a small number, but it is a number nonetheless.
Thank you.
And why was it? Sorry, Representative Davis, please.
I believe I have the same question. And why was it canceled?
Simply, for whatever reason, there's many, many reasons we couldn't collect on it, and it's been written off. We don't expect to get that money.
Representative Davis, follow up?
Thank you, Chair. I presume, in large part, it's because there's no equity left in the homes and no assets left in the estate. But that's just an assumption.
Now, this debt is a debt of the property, isn't it? Is it a debt of the estate as well?
It could be, Chair Barnhart. It could be a debt of the estate, but that's tied to the property.
All right. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So I was just curious if any of the changes happening with the core system replacement would be helpful in trying to get some of the canceled debt, or if it's more like Representative Davis was saying, that it's more just the fact that the estate or the property doesn't have the equity.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vega Peterson, we have high hopes that the core systems replacement will give us great efficiencies that will make our job easier to do and hopefully easier to collect money that is owed to the program.
Great. Representative Whitsitt, please.
It just seems to me that this program should be based on the value of the property, not on the total. I go back to what I was talking about before, where the property may be worth $250,000 in Salem and Klamath Falls, but you're paying $1,250 in Klamath Falls and $6,000 in Salem because it's packing all of this bonded indebtedness for schools and all this sort of thing. So it seems to me like the program could be adjusted better so it reflects the value of the property, that instead of all of the other bonds that are stuck onto property tax. I mean, it just seems like it would make it easier for you to recover the value of the property instead of what you're trying to recover is, in fact, school loans and all kinds of stuff that's stuck on.
Representative Whitsitt, that may be a subject of a bill.
I know,
rather than something for the administrator. Yes, Representative Vega Peterson.
I would just to respond to that comment, I understand the point that you're making. I think looking at why we have the program, though, for me, it's about keeping senior and disabled in their homes, and whether or not we add on those or not. If you don't add it on, they're still going to have to come up with that money somehow.
I recognize. I was just thinking of the recovery aspect of the value of.
One of the things that happened during the time that we were in crisis was we actually did. The department did delve into some of these accounts to figure out why we were having the difficulty we were with collecting the funds. And perhaps after the core system is in place and you have the capacity to actually ask additional questions, it might be useful to figure out what the specific problem was that led to the lack of resources to repay these loans in the future, because that would help us a lot in figuring out how to make the kinds of adjustments that the statute probably could use. We tried to be pretty conservative when we were working on saving the account, but we did it in a vacuum. We had very little data to go on, and so we made up some things which turned out to be good enough. They weren't perfect, but they were good enough to they worked. And they were based more on logic than they were on data. And so, as things get moving along and you're able to run more of this through the core systems process, I think it might be very helpful for future committees to have a better understanding of what's working and what isn't. It may very well be that some of these requirements we have we don't need and that we can open the program to more people. And it may be that other requirements aren't tight enough because they subject the account to loss that would affect everybody else on the program. And so that would be a suggestion I would have that you might think about as you're working on that core system replacement. Now, I think you're at the bottom slide, aren't you? Did you have more to present today?
I'm complete.
You're complete. Representative Smith-Warner, you're not complete yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just guess I kind of wanted to confirm that despite those couple of exceptions for people who were on it with a reverse mortgage who got either to stay on it or put back on it, any new applicant, you still can't have a reverse mortgage and get onto this unless you were in that class that you were kicked off either because of the one reason or then because of the two reasons. One of the two reasons. Is that correct?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, that's correct. There's a small cohort that can still reapply if they want to and have a reverse mortgage. But largely speaking, you cannot have a reverse mortgage and be on the program going forward.
Thank you. Quick follow-up.
Yes, please.
Is there a time limit on that, on those folks to reapply who got kicked off for one of those reasons? Is there a sunset on that?
Not at this time.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate very much the presentation and the fact that the account is still solvent. We guessed right a few times, and you've done a great job of administering the thing so that it actually works for the people who are on it and who are able to stay in their homes as a result of that work. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. With that, we'll close the information meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill. Which one is we have the most people on? 2083. Kyle?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, before I introduce 2083, I'll just let the committee members know that on OLIS, under meeting materials, under House Bill 2083, I did include, there's about three or four pages from the basic facts publication, so that's the orientation we go through at the beginning of session related to property tax relief. The bulk of that is describing the senior deferral program. So there's some background in there. There's also a tracking of the bill changes that have happened recently. Much of that was just described by the Department of Revenue. But I would urge people to take a look at that because I think it does give a pretty good history of where we were before 2007, 2008, and then the changes that were made and some of the reasons or the numbers behind some of the reasons why the decisions were made. But so that is there in OLIS.
Very good. Now on to the bill.
Okay, on to House Bill 2083. So we do have an amendment for this bill. I'm going to describe 2083, and then we can get to the amendment. So what the bill would do as drafted is it would create an exception to the five-year ownership requirement for a homestead of a claimant for deferral if the claimant for deferral moved to the homestead from a homestead that met the requirements of the deferral program. So if their previous house met all the requirements of the deferral program, if someone who a senior or a disabled individual moves to a new home, they would no longer have to wait that 5 years before they could receive deferral on their new home, so long as both of these would meet the requirements of the program. It would allow the deferral of homestead if it is insurable for fire and other causality. So the difference there is right now property has to have insurance. Under this change, the homestead just has to be insurable, and then the bill goes on to allow the Department of Revenue to purchase insurance for the homestead and add the cost of that to the lien of the deferred taxes. Another change is it would eliminate the qualification criteria related to the function of real market value of the homestead in relation to county median RMV and the number of years the claimant has continuously owned and lived in the homestead. So that's under existing law right now. It would eliminate the prohibition of pledging a homestead receiving deferral as security for a reverse mortgage. And it would make some changes to the eligibility of claims filed under certain circumstances to be granted in the order that they're received. So that's a change the department hit on this, where there was a limit put in place. If we were to exceed that limit, I think it was 700 that they mentioned. Right now, under current law, they'd be taken based on the homestead's percentage relation to median RMV in the county in which it's located. So the change would be they would just take them on a first-come, first-served basis. Rather than doing that calculation, there's a repeal statutes that are made irrelevant because of the other changes in the bill, and it would take effect on the 91st day following sine die.
Okay. Now, are you going to describe the amendment? Because the amendment looks like a replacement.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The amendment is a gut and stuff that's still related to the deferral program. We have.
I'm assuming that the witnesses are going to talk to the amendment.
Yes, we have Multnomah County here to talk.
Okay,
to
so let's amendment. Let's describe that one first. Next, then, please. The amendment, please.
Oh, Mr. Chair, yeah, I was going to allow the proposed amendment, the proponents of it, to describe it. There's testimony up there as well that
all
steps
right.
through it.
Okay, then we can do that. Question. Well, I think the thing we're actually going to consider is the amendment, I suspect. So let's hear from Chris Fick, Lee Gerard, and Randy Walruff.
Good afternoon.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Fick with Multnomah County's Office of Government Relations. Thank you very much for holding this hearing in conjunction with the update that we just received from DOR. Hopefully everyone's minds are primed. And we can not only use some of the questions that were raised to give our perspectives, but also follow up on some of the issues that were raised around reverse mortgages. The bill that and the amendments that you see before you are a result of some feedback that our elected officials have gotten in Multnomah County.
about problems with the current program and perhaps some unintended consequences as a result of the legislation that has been passed by previous legislatures. It's also a result of the experience our aging and assessment department have had in working with folks in the program who have been struck from the program or made ineligible as a result of these changes. So we're trying to capitalize on the experiences that we have at the local level to make sure that eligibility is increased and that seniors can age in place if they're able to do so. Ms. Girard is going to talk at length about the benefits that accrue both to the state and locally as a result of allowing people to age in place. And I'm sure you guys have already heard an earful about the benefits that those seniors receive as a result of the program. I want to start off by saying, before I summarize the Dash 1 amendments, that this bill does not go as far as we had hoped. We did hope to take it into a better account, reverse mortgages and how they may threaten the status of a lien for someone in the program. What I mean by that is that reverse mortgages come in all different shapes and sizes and flavors, and a reverse mortgage may not actually threaten the state status for a deferred lien, like just the same way that a standard mortgage would. And truth be told, a lot of participants in the program right now still are paying off their first mortgage or their second mortgage, and so they don't have 100% equity in their home. The same thing is true for folks in a reverse mortgage. Some people can take out a very modest amount and still have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equity. Others can plan to take out all of it over the course of the remainder of their lives. But it was our desire to have the Department of Revenue look with a finer tooth comb, go through with a finer tooth comb, and determine what sort of reverse mortgage actually threatens the potential equity as a result of being enrolled in this program. As they just said, and as we've kind of come to understand, right now they don't have that ability, but that's disappointing to us because, as you've seen from the number of people that were eliminated from the program, overwhelmingly those are folks that have reverse mortgages. And we can talk about retirement security and savings, but increasingly for seniors who are living longer, after their working years, a reverse mortgage is a necessary component of their financial future, and eliminating this tool from determining how they age in place is unfortunate from our vantage point. But with that being said, let me summarize the Dash 1 amendments that are before you. So we are looking to exempt the elimination of participants from the five-year residency requirement if they purchase a home of lesser value within 1 year of selling their home and put at least 20% down. The 20% down reflects the fact that when people buy a new home, they may not have as much equity. So this is a lump sum payment to determine, to give DOR some assurance that they will have an opportunity to get their loan repaid. It would allow the Department of Revenue to offer to purchase fire and other casualty insurance for otherwise eligible participants who did not have such insurance and add that to the cost of their lien. It would require the Department of Revenue to contact the local aging and disability resource connection of any participant who fails to respond to a notice of certification and give the ADRC 90 days with which to assist in the recertification of that participant. Ms. Girard is going to talk a little bit about why we think some of those re-enrollment numbers for people who are kicked off the program are so low, and we think it's because they didn't have the proper assistance that they could use to do so. And it would increase the countywide median value limits that were referenced earlier by 10% for each residency time. It's sort of a stair-step process. The longer you live in your home, the more valuable your home can be. So it's by 10% through years 5 through 20, through 21, and then it jumps up to 225% for years 23 through 25 and 250% for those living in their homes for over 25 years. Mr. Walruff, our assessor, is going to talk about how gentrification in certain parts of Portland have resulted in people bumping up against these limits and aging out. Our hope is to really target additional value relief, if you will, to those who have lived in their homes the longest. And this, the other amendment delays implementation of these changes to tax year 2016 to give the department time to implement them. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Girard.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and committee members. I'm Lee Girard, and I'm a senior manager with Multnomah County Aging, Disability, and Veteran Services Division. And I'm here really asking for your support for this bill and for the amendments. Our agency is the member of a four-county Aging and Disability Resource Connection Consortium. So we have some perspectives to bring from that experience. And also this year we have been responsible for implementing the distribution of the one-time financial assistance to older adults who are experiencing financial hardship from the 3 years that they were excluded from the senior property tax deferral program. And that was actually funding that was allocated by the legislature this last year as part of the senior special purpose appropriations. So we have some of that experience to share with you as well. So the importance of making sure that we have a really good and robust senior property tax deferral program. This House bill supports older adults being able to age in place in their communities. I don't think it's any surprise to any of you, Oregon is known nationally for providing older adults with a variety of care options that allow them to remain in their home and connected in their communities. Almost 50% of individuals that are receiving Medicaid long-term services and supports, so these are very low-income folks, receive those services in their home. So maintaining older adults in their homes helps individuals to utilize their resources more effectively. And for many people who are not yet eligible for Medicaid, it actually helps them to either postpone or avoid needing to go on to public assistance. And so those are really kind of key things to think about as far as the long-term impact to public funding. We know that it's a significant challenge for people remaining at home as their care needs increase. One of the really significant challenges is making sure that they have affordable housing options. Older adults are on fixed incomes, and as they age, the cost of home ownership actually becomes a bigger proportion of their overall limited income. The changes proposed in the House bill and the amendments will ensure that older adults who are at the higher risk financially actually have access to this really important program. Also, I'd really like to ask that you support the amendment to the House bill that would require the Department of Revenue to contact the appropriate Aging and Disability Resource Connection for any current applicant who fails to re-enroll. This would give the ADRC 90 days to assist the applicant before removing them from the program. It's been our experience in administering the one-time financial assistance program for this year that many of these individuals have faced really significant barriers in the application process. Some of the examples that we've seen is that people are needing assistance with the actual application due to cognition issues, literacy issues, vision and hearing issues that just make it a significant challenge. We're also finding that people are needing assistance in accessing money management and financial counseling. Those are very important services that we can help people access. And we're also finding as we contact these people that they have many, many other needs that nobody's really been able to help them, has helped them with. So things like accessing other public benefits that would help their financial situation and potentially make it easier for them to afford their paying their property taxes if they're not eligible for the program. And then also assisting accessing other services that will actually help them to remain in their home, things like transportation and grocery shopping, things like that. One of the things that we found from the administering this program, administering the financial hardship program, is that people need a lot of assistance actually applying. We sent out notices to 360 people, and we've actually helped 330 of those folks apply, but almost none of them responded to the initial mailing that we sent out. We had to take extra steps to help people with applying for that financial assistance. And so far, we've got 330 people that were actually in the queue to get financial assistance. But if we had not taken the extra step, that would not have happened. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Randy Walroff. My title is Multnomah County Assessor, but the division that I supervise and manage, we are also the county tax collector and the majority of the county clerk functions. And we also manage tax foreclosed properties, and we have to market it and sell it, those and deal with those too. And the point of telling you about that will come clear here in a few moments. I've been asked to talk about a few aspects of our organization's experience with this over the last couple of years. When this first passed, we had a crisis, as the chair mentioned. The first thing that struck me was that we weren't not just changing the rules for new people. We were retroactively requiring new applications. And so when the first letters were sent out, and I want to note, and it was just referenced, these people, many of them have been in the program many, many years. They were never asked to send a letter back. And the Department of Revenue does their best job with the equipment and the core, they're talking about their core replacement system. The letter, as it turned out, was something that you would see typed up 20 or 30 years ago. So here's people, as just been mentioned, with all these issues, been in their home for many years, and a letter shows up. So when the Department of Revenue had their first status of how many people hadn't returned the letter and they were within 30 days of being kicked out, we stepped up at Multnomah County and said, we need that list. And I have 24 residential appraisers in the field. So we gave that. We divided it up, and we gave it to the appraisers, and they started knocking on doors. And they found all kinds of situations. Many were just detailed back then. They're not trained social service workers. They're property appraisers. But then they came back and said, we have numerous issues out here. And then they got in contact with gatekeepers, our social service people, and a lot of these people were helped. But many of them, it was too late. They didn't answer the door. They weren't there. I could go on and on about the things that our appraisers found out in the field. That told me that we had an issue with the letter to begin with and the recertification. So we had been working with our social service people, trying to find ways to do this and make them more informed. So that's the first issue that we had with this. The second thing is as we've worked into the program, the market value fix seemed somewhat good to begin with because every county is different. The same home in Coos Bay could be worth three times as much out in Rockwood. So a little starter home in Rockwood has taxes of $3,000 a year, and the person may have lived there for 40 years, and it's a 1,200-square-foot starter home, and its taxes are going to be $3,400, and its value is $250,000. You can get a mansion in some parts of the state for that. So would we pay the taxes on the mansion but not on the little starter home in Rockwood? And Chair Barhart's well aware of that, and that's why he helped craft this and helped fix that problem. The problem in Multnomah County, which I won't say we're totally unique, but due to rapid gentrification of areas of especially inner north and northeast Portland, we have such a divergent values out there. The change property ratio by which new properties calculated at, our average assessed value to market value in that area, you'll find vast areas up there of 25% assessed value to market value. Other areas are 95% to 100%, like out in Rockwood, because they've had different dynamics going on out there. So the countywide helps, but we're finding that it actually is kicking people out. If we had a smaller county up there, then maybe the number would be twice as big. And we've tried to slice and dice it all different ways, and it's really hard to do. So we find people bumping up against that. And I'm going to tell you the story real quickly here in a minute of two people. Next was the issue about fire insurance. And I've been in government for 38 years. And 7 years in the middle of my stay with the Multnomah County, I worked for the Veterans Affairs as a loan officer, a property manager, and a property appraiser. When our people that we loaned money to didn't provide proof of fire insurance, we purchased it for them. So just recently, we called the Department of Veterans Affairs, and yes, they still have the same program. My special programs manager found out all this in an hour. Banks do it. My bank accidentally on my new loan didn't get the stuff from my fire insurance company. They said, well, we're buying insurance for you, but you might want to buy your own because ours is like twice as much. So I quickly called my agent, and he took care of it. But some of these people don't have that ability. They don't remember that they didn't pay their fire insurance bill, or maybe they just didn't turn the paperwork in. Because remember, we haven't been checking in all these years. So then I called my risk management people because we manage tax foreclosed properties. Are they not covered by fire insurance? They said, you're covered. When you buy a property, we cover it for you. We do deal with our insurance company. So we know we can purchase it. We know it can be done because the financial industry does it all day long, every day of the year. So my manager that manages, she says, well, why don't we just find out first who was their insurance company? Help them. And that's what we would hope social services with this 90-day provision would help. If you're getting kicked out for fire insurance, let's find out who they were. Maybe you still have it and you just don't know. So the next thing on this was the retroactive. And I have two people, and I think it's okay to say their name. But I'll just say that they're, one is a
older lady. She's 84. She lives on Northeast 12th in Portland. Her home was built in 1910, and it's 1,800 square feet. She's lived in the home over 40 years, and she owns it free and clear. She has a $3,000 little lien we just found for something Portland Development Commission helped her with years ago. Her income is Social Security and retirement benefits. She's been in the program 25 years. She was disqualified from the program for the 2014 tax year due to the property's RMV exceeding the median RMV limit for people in their homes for 25-plus years of $469,660. That value is based on the value from the year before. So it's too late for her to appeal that value, and the department needs to have a number in the past so that they can process it this year. She exceeds the median limit by $7,270. She has no path to appeal that value for the previous year. She feels that her neighborhood, and she writes in her appeal that she did not prevail. She feels that her neighborhood is undergoing, quote, subtle gentrification, and claims poor people and people of color are being taxed out of the neighborhood by rising property values and higher taxes. She begs to get to age in her home that she's lived in all these years. Her taxes are $4,483 a year. I speculate she will not be paying those taxes. The next person, and I'm only giving you two, is a lady that's 95 years old. She lives on Northeast Alameda, a very nice area. She's been there over 60 years. The value 60 years ago, she probably could have bought a house in many parts of Portland, and she wouldn't now have the luxury of having a home, and I'm not sure she'd call it a luxury right now, worth a lot of money. Her home is worth $864,000. The limit's $469,000. She's been in the deferral program 27 years, but she had no chance of getting in the other program. She was removed from the program in 2011. Now, she still owes the money to the state for those years, and the state's not going after it. But I'm required to go after her taxes by law. She's $60,000 delinquent with interest right now. She's in her fourth year of delinquency. I will be starting foreclosure action soon. In two more years, if someone doesn't get in there and help her, I will have to somehow work with my social service people to figure out how to get her out of the house. I do not like that part of my job. I hate that part of my job. So the medium is skewed because I have neighborhoods like that. She's lived there 60 years. If I could slice and dice it up, those 30,000 accounts up there, maybe the average value is $900,000. And they're not big homes. It's just that the market in that part of Portland has been gentrified, and I don't know what to do about it. So I'm open to any questions. We've had a lot of experience with this, and I thank you for your time today.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Whitson.
I just wanted to, the $60,000 in delinquent, did she accumulate that in the last 4 years that she's?
Yes, her property taxes are $13,135 this last year.
Plus interest.
And she's accumulating 16% interest from the moment that the department stopped paying her property taxes for her. And I also note she owns her home free and clear. So it is a policy decision, politics as you would say, and I'm not going to jump into that one. I'm just going to point out that we have a property worth $865,000 here, and a policy that I believe is to help citizens age in place. And yes, she's very lucky. And someone told me, well, she should sell that house and downsize. But she can't get back in the program right now. So the five-year thing at least would allow her to get back in the program if she did sell and downsize. You may choose to have a program where she stays in place because I believe we're well secured, in my opinion.
I suspect you're right. Representative Vega Peterson. This bill, as written, would not help that second lady, would it?
Unfortunately, I just showed this one to Chris today. The 250% change helps a lot of our people. It helps my first example.
It does not help this second one, Chair Barnhart.
This stuff gets a little emotional, I'm sorry, because I've been doing taxes a long time, and I see so many different exemptions.
You deal with these things up front.
Yes, sir.
And close.
And I would propose to Chris, and he said I could go ahead and say it, is perhaps we say that if you qualify and you're in the program and you haven't done anything to your property, remember, Measure 50 limits those people's assessed value. They don't pay any more taxes than 1995 values, less 10%. Plus 3% per year, unless they do something. So here's people that have lived in their home for 60 years and they haven't done anything, and all of a sudden the government is saying you're out. She hasn't done anything. She's just lived there. So my proposal would be that you don't get kicked out if you haven't done anything. She hasn't added on. She hasn't remodeled. She hasn't done anything but lived in this home of 60 years.
The only thing I'll add is that by other all other criteria of qualifications, we believe she qualifies. So she has a net worth of less than $500,000. We're not talking about this woman in particular, but all the other requirements in general under this bill would still be in place. So income, net worth, age, all the other things we're not proposing to change.
Net worth not counting the
value
property
of your
itself,
property,
right,
correct,
which is excluded.
Yes.
Yeah. Other questions for this panel? Representative Leininger, please.
I just want to note that I think you made a really compelling case, and as you were finishing up, and I love the sort of the zeal with which you think about these issues, and I think it's a real testament to your wonderful public service that you're all here and passionately advocating. I think that's really honorable and wonderful. I was thinking about when I first got to know of the senior property tax deferral, it was in actually 2011, I think, and I live in Lake Oswego. I represent Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and the way I got to know about it were these expose gotcha stories about roughly that person, unfortunately, you know, in Lake Oswego. Might have been almost exactly, it might have been comparably sympathetic facts, but, you know, when people heard about it, they got super frustrated and energized, and I bring it up to just simply say I agree with you. That seems like a really compelling story, and as policy people, it's hard to figure out how we deal with that set of facts, because I'm pretty sure the reason that some of these law changes happened were because of sets of facts like that that we in this room might all agree are really sympathetic, and that some other people would call the travesty, and it's not an easy thing to answer, but thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Leininger. If I may, the only thing I would point out is that there were, as you'll recall, $1 million homes that were enrolled, and I'll defer to the chair and other people around the committee at the time. I'm not sure if the people who were in the program at that time, I know the criteria was not based on longevity in your home, but I don't believe that those folks had been in the program for long. Under this bill where we're keeping this ramp-up program, at 250%, there's no $1 million homes.
Right.
The highest median county average is $274,000 in Washington County, and that doesn't get you close to a $1 million home. If you then grandfather people additionally who have been in for 25 years and met all the other criteria, you're probably talking about a very small, I don't want to say minuscule, but you're probably talking about a very small subset of people that would be even in $800,000 homes.
Right. And if I may make a follow-up comment, I find this really sympathetic, and I would support, you know, I support what you're talking about, but I guess it's just a cautionary tale that it's easy to choose the most hard to identify with set of facts, but there are a lot of really worthwhile situations like what you're talking about, and I do support what you're advocating for.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you so much for all of the time. I know you guys have spent a lot of time looking at this issue, and I really appreciate the work that you've done to try to craft a program that really gets people to stay in their home and really which is the heart of why we have this program in the first place. So I appreciate all your work on that. I'm interested in looking at the Dash 1 amendments and really kind of digging into those to see if there's something that we can do to get at the issues that people are facing. We've had a lot of conversations about the property tax and the inequities in the property tax system and how that affects different parts. So I appreciate your work, because it's a really complicated issue to try to figure out one policy that matches all the different property tax situations that we find. I appreciate your work.
Thank you. It makes me wonder how many people in similar circumstances that you described were missed in other counties where the assessor wasn't so proactive to go find the people who'd received the letter but not responded, and then also to enlist the social service agencies. I think about my own counties, Lane and Linn County, and I have no idea whether they did the things that you did or not. But I suspect that there are people in many places outside of Multnomah County that were missed simply because nobody went to the door to inquire. That gives me pause as we think about it. One other thought, it isn't completely clear to me at this late date whether any of the changes that we made, barring a couple of ones that maybe have to do with the five-year hiatus rule, which basically prevented new purchasers from using our program as part of their
of their purchase plan to buy a larger house than they might otherwise be able to afford. Other than that one, I'm not sure that any of the changes we made are what's responsible for the improvement in the fund. The fact is, we simply don't know. The economy has improved significantly in the meantime, and a bunch of other things have occurred in the meantime. So that's one of those interesting facts. I have a couple other witnesses. If I can move on,
yeah,
be okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mark, Garst, and Marcia Kelly. Different topics, I'm sure. We just got this morning.
The amendments just came in about 10:30.
10:30. Okay. So the amendment's brand new, but it's what we're talking about.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, again, for the record, Mark Garst from the Oregon Department of Revenue. I wanted to speak a little bit about the bill today. You just said, Chair Barnhart, we haven't actually read the language in the bill. We have been working pretty closely with Chris, Mr. Fick, though, and so we feel like we kind of came into this having a pretty good idea of what the changes were going to be, and so I'd just like to speak to some of those changes. I think that everybody's in agreement about the goals of the program, and that is to pay the property taxes for folks who are eligible. The bill, as it's actually written now, without the amendment, makes some pretty wide-ranging changes, and I think that we would have a lot of concerns. It modifies the existing homeownership requirement, adds the ability of revenue to purchase property insurance, removes limits on the real market value, allows reverse mortgages again, and it was granting requests in the order that they were received as opposed to based on need, which is how it's structured now. Many of these changes would undo 2011 legislation, and much as you said, it's hard to say whether those changes are actually what improved the health of the fund. I mean, there are so many variables there that would probably be too far of a statement, but you know, I think it's safe to say that limiting the value of homes that can come in limits the amount of property tax payments that you're making. I think that when we capped the number of new folks who could come into the program, that probably had a lot to do with the health of it. But we would have some concerns about that. And then also administratively, there would be some pretty serious issues. But as I said before, since the bill was introduced, we've been working with the sponsors on this Dash 1 amendment, and we feel like the changes that have been made really temper some of the issues that we had the most problem with, especially administratively. And, you know, but I just want to make sure that we're aware that were the bill to pass without amendment, we would have some pretty significant issues. But speaking to the amendment itself, we've seen only the draft, and these are based off of our best understanding, you know, coming into the meeting today. First of all, on the five-year ownership requirement, the program, as we've talked about, currently has a five-year ownership requirement. The stated goal of the program was to keep seniors in their homes. These changes would alter that a little bit, and maybe now the goal is to allow people to downsize, to move closer to their relatives and whatnot, which is certainly a laudable goal. So the it will specify that as long as they reapply within 1 year of selling the home, that they would be able to get onto the program in a home that had a lower real market value than the home that they moved from, and as long as they put down at least 20% is how it's structured as far as we're aware. We are a little concerned only about the requirement related to equity. And that would create an additional administrative burden on the department. Right now, we don't really look at loan-to-value issues. That's never really been a part of the deferral program, is judging people based on loan-to-value. So there would be a little bit more work that we would have to do. And we are a little bit concerned with the way we think the bill's written, which would be that it just says real market value and not as determined by the county assessor. So in other words, there would be maybe a debate sometimes about what the value of the home actually is. And so we may end up litigating that. Without the 20% down requirement, we wouldn't think that there would be any fiscal, and we believe that we could implement the change pretty easily. The next issue was the fire and casualty insurance. Program participants currently are required to carry homeowners insurance, and I think that was an intentional thing on the part of the legislature to kind of protect our investment. The proposed amendment will allow deferral in cases where the home is insurable but not insured. And then it also allows the department to go out and purchase insurance for the homeowner. So it would put us in a position where we would have that ability to go ahead and protect the value of our lien. As long as the language remains permissive, we don't see that there would be a significant fiscal impact for us, because we may or may not purchase that insurance the way that we understand the bill to be structured. But I think that Mr. Walriff really hit the nail on the head when he said that, you know, I purchased something and then my mortgage company imposed the insurance on, and whoa, it was quite a bit more expensive than what I paid when I went out and got the insurance myself. And, you know, we also spoke to the folks at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs about the program, about how they purchase it. And they said that when they force place a policy, that it's usually quite expensive. And the example that they gave us was $2,500 a year on a $250,000 house. And I did a very non-scientific Google survey on Oregon homeowners insurance, and I think that a more average rate is $576 a year. So it does seem that when the government purchases from a single provider this insurance and imposes it without going through the normal process where the insurance company gets to come out and look at your house, they get to ask you questions about it, when you just impose it, that it can be quite a bit more expensive. In reality, this issue may not be quite that significant. I mean, I'm sure it's very significant for the 25 people a year who are denied access to the program because they do not have insurance, but that is about what the number has been for the last 2 years. It's about 25 folks who are denied an application. Okay. Regarding the real market value limits, Representative Langer, I think that you kind of picked up on what we were a little concerned about, and that is just sometimes it does look like these high-dollar homes, it can add a little bit of it can invite scrutiny on the part of the public, and I think people sometimes do get a little upset when they hear about this. I remember the same stories, and it was million-dollar homes. So right now, the highest average value for a county, median value is The highest value is $284,280. So, and based on this, these changes as they're structured, if the senior had been in their home for 25 years, right now they qualify for 200% of the median real market value. This would only change it. This would change it to 250%. And so basically the highest dollar home in Oregon that could qualify is going to go from a current $568,500 to just over $710,000. So we're still not going to be giving it to any million-dollar homes. The way that it's structured. All things being equal, seniors who have been in their homes longer tend to have more equity, and so I think we often do have a better chance of recapturing the money that the state is in effect lending them. So this proposed change is administratively simple. All we have to do, the way that it's written now, is just to update some tables in our computer system, and we can obviously do that with no fiscal impact. The last thing that I'll discuss are the additional notification requirements. The department is currently required to recertify program eligibility not less than once every 3 years. As Mr. Ueda said, we currently switch it up, and we do it every 2 years. Notifications are sent out in late January or early February. Starting in 2013, in large part because of the efforts of Mr. Walriff, the department began sending weekly notices to the counties in mid-March. So we're talking about, they include the name of the program participants and the fact that they had not responded. So they're given 65 days, and basically a month before that deadline is going to hit, then we start getting in touch with the counties as it stands now. And we do weekly notices in order to keep them up to speed. There were some issues that were discussed about the letter, and, you know, we had a lot of complaints when we first started doing the recertifications. This is a relatively new thing for us, and we got the message. So, you know, the letter has been reworked. The counties have signed off on it now, and I think it's something that is more easily digested by the folks who are the target of that communication. So as it stands now, if the participant does not respond within 65 days, typically in mid-April, the homestead is ineligible for deferral the following property tax year. Now, taxpayers who are rendered ineligible through this process may then go to the director of the Department of Revenue under ORS 311-681 and request for a retroactive deferral. And so basically they just come to the director, okay, you met all the other requirements except for you filed late. Can I please have a retroactive deferral to continue my participation in the program? And as long as they've met those standards, we've pretty much been very liberal in the way that we've allowed those to go through. So in my written testimony, you'll find some statistics, but in 2013, we mailed about 2,500 recertifications. We got no response on about 238. We only got 10 of the requests for director's review, and we approved 7. But then in 2014, we mailed 3,200, roughly, recertifications. We got about 400 no response. 111 of those folks came back and asked for a retroactive application, and 106 of those 111 were approved. So basically, you know, if you're meeting the standards of the program, we're going to allow it. And I heard some concern earlier about the number of folks who are not recertifying under the program. Well, there could be a lot of factors that, you know, lead someone to decide that they don't need the program one year where they may have needed it in the past. They could have a disqualifying event, and they simply know, you know, this year, I've had a windfall. I'm not going to be able to qualify for the program, and that might be the reason that they choose not to recertify. So it would be nice if we could track some of that stuff, as it's been alluded to, but it could be a little challenging because really we don't know why some folks don't reapply. So the proposed amendment language would add a requirement that we notify the County Office of Aging and Disability Resource Connection, ADRC, if they fail to recertify, and give the taxpayer an additional 90 days to respond. We have a concern that this additional 90 days would put us beyond the beginning of the tax year. So if the April 15th is kind of our target date that folks are supposed to be doing it now under the 65 days, if you add 90 to that, then we're May, June, July, we're mid-July, and July 1 is the start of the tax year. And the way the statute reads, it says that if they don't timely respond, then they don't get it for the next year. So the inadvertent thing that would happen with this language is that they wouldn't actually get disqualified until a year after we were intending for them to be disqualified, based on my intent of what the bill sponsors are after. So
let me interrupt. And
sure.
Because I think what you said earlier was you're actually are making giving notice to somebody. I don't know that
we
I
are now. Yeah,
who
to the to Mr. Walriff and other county assessors.
Okay, and it looks like they would like you to notify somebody else.
Yeah, and we could happily do that.
Would you do that?
Absolutely.
Without a statute change?
We could do that without a statute change, as long as legislative council is of the opinion that it's okay for us to share the names and addresses of the folks who have failed to recertify with this agency. So that would be the only question that we'd have.
All right.
But we'd be happy to do it without a statute change. If you wanted to put it in statute to make sure that we could give them that information, we'd be happy to do that as well.
Okay. And I just looked at the proposed language, and you're right, that is what it says, and I had misread it in terms of the timing. Please go ahead.
That, you know, pretty much is what I have to say. There could be a bit of an administrative burden when you bring someone else into the process. We feel like we've gotten pretty good at communicating at this point with the folks, with the seniors. There are a lot of complexities about this program that, you know, as Bronson kind of alluded to, all the different cohorts. So you can't exactly tell somebody in the, you know, a social worker that this is what you have to do to qualify for the program. Because it really could vary depending on your situation, which of those cohorts you're in. Maybe you were in deferral at one point, there was a disqualifying event, and the legislature has since said that you can go ahead and get back into the program. So, but basically, if we were just to do the notice, you know, the same way that we do it to the assessors and do it now for the community group, that we don't think that there would be any fiscal impact from that, and we think we could administer it pretty quickly.
Now, look, I appreciate the fact that the department can do this without additional money. What I'm much more interested in is what the effect on the fund would be of making these changes. And that would be where the information that I think the committee needs to have before, as we consider any additional changes in the program.
So, Chair Barnhart, my understanding is that the forecast that we gave you reflect the current statutes to the best of our ability as far as forecasting goes.
Yes.
But as Bronson alluded to, you know, we looked at different scenarios. We looked at three scenarios, and one of them looked much better, and one of them looked much worse. So if you assume that the housing market's going to continue, you know, as it has been, or even if you consider it to cool down a little bit but not do anything like 2009, then we feel like we're going to be okay. If you think that we might have another housing bubble type event, then as Bronson said, those lines start to cross, and we are in a situation where the balance starts to decline. So, you know, knowing what the effect is going to be is really difficult for us, and, you know, and all the changes over the years make it kind of hard to say what was responsible for what in the forecast.
So. Okay, well, I would appreciate it if you would work with the Legislative Revenue Office and see if we can do a little bit better than that. We may not be able to. That may be the best we can do. But, I mean, I think about the parallels between today and 2007, and I think that, I mean, we were facing a kicker that year. We're facing a kicker this year. We're facing a Fed that is thinking about fiscal tightening and increasing interest rates. The market looks like it's kind of toppy. Who knows where we're going from here? But what does that have to do with the housing market? I have absolutely no idea. And this program worked just great for 30 years before the bottom fell out of it. But you know, when I sit and look at an amendment like this, I have to think about what does this do to the fund? Because the last thing we want to do is to tell the people who are on the program, sorry, we're done, the fund is bankrupt, we can't do this anymore. Because, and especially that would be the case if the reason why we did that was because we had liberalized the program and made the outgo too large for it to handle. So I appreciate the fact that there's no fiscal for the department, but what's the fiscal for the fund? I think that's really important. Shall we go on, please? Mr. Mullen?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm sorry I'm here a little late. I was in a work group, and I did not hear the projection, but I'll go back and look at the information. Mr. Chair, I want to pick up on your last comments because I want to begin by thanking this committee and your leadership for the work that was done over the last couple of biennia about adjusting, including the work that Representative Vega Peterson took a lead on, House Bill 2510, which were really basically adjustments to the program for people who had been eliminated from the program and being able to add people back in two steps. And I think that was really very prudent on the part of this committee and the part of the legislature to make that happen. But I am very pleased that Multnomah County has brought forth this particular bill, because really what it's then saying is that are there some permanent changes to the program that we ought to make for people that would be applying in the future? And I think these are things that are well worth considering, and I agree, Mr. Chair, with your concern about the fund itself, because we do want to make sure that we don't create a problem with people entering into the program and then having to make adjustments later on. But I think there might be, as you do this work, some areas of maybe a little bit of a risk, but some things that are really going to be important for people. The 5-year rule, which had some interesting rationale to begin with, now as we've teased this out and really thought about really what's involved, particularly if people are downsizing and changing their lifestyle to make sure that they can stay independent, I think that's a policy idea that we would all support. I particularly also want to say that I really appreciate the fact that Multnomah County has put this in a social service context. The Aging Disability Resource Connection is really an excellent idea about making sure that we reach out to people who may have other kinds of issues going on besides their inability to pay property taxes. So in the final analysis, I just would say that I'm very interested to work with this committee and with Multnomah County if, in fact, we can make some prudent adjustments to the program to help people in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I, too, am pleased to see that there may be some potential changes in the program. I would just ask that when statistics are being gathered by the program and when recertification is made, that we get one other note. I looked at the Oregon State study, and 71% of the program participants that responded to their study were single. The remainder were married. But there's no knowledge of whether they're males or females. And one of the issues of keeping people in their homes as they age, and one of the issues for females, is because of the historical lack of wages and equitable wages, women have fewer resources. And I'm just asking that you consider getting more demographics so that we can sort of track and so that we know what are happening to our older population and who exactly we need to reach out to and how the best way is to reach out to them. In a really perfect world, I think we also might look at something other than the countywide average for values of homes to keep people in their homes, because I know that my in-laws' home in Northeast Portland off of Prescott value is incredibly different than our approximately same size home. It's higher, is different than our home in the Fairmont Hills area of Salem. And if you want to know where that is, we have a very small home, but it's a block from the governor's house.
Ah, bravo. Thank you. Questions for this panel? I think we have work to do on this bill. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2083. Colleagues, we have two other bills. Is there one? Anybody wants to be heard on 2131? There are some people on 2131. Boy. All right. And 2217, we have someone to be heard on that one as well.
I think
is he left? All right. Do I have time to do 2131? I don't have any idea what the complexity of this bill is.
It's the MDAC bill.
Oh.
Treasury, yeah. That folks are here if you
want to
introduce it.
Yeah, well, why don't we introduce it, and then if we don't get finished, we have a very, very short period of time.
We don't have the other committee in the room, so.
Oh, they don't? Oh, okay.
But you have the meeting at 3.
Yeah.
We couldn't work this bill because I'm ready to vote for it.
Oh, you're ready to work? Okay. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2489. Representative Bentz, let's reintroduce the bill. This was the bill on the provisions for expiration of cigarette taxes.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2489. This came to us from the Department of Revenue on their behalf. We do have the paperwork in OLIS. We have the fiscal. There's no fiscal, and there's a minimal revenue impact, along with a bit of an explanation on why we have that.
Right. This one went by really quickly. I was thinking we weren't going to work it today because Representative Bentz had questions. I let him talk because I think these questions have been answered.
They have been. Thank you, Chair. The bill is one of those modest bills with much to be modest about, and yet it's necessary. And so I'm going to support it. I took way too much time figuring out how to work, and I'm kind of embarrassed that it took so long, but I do understand the bill, and we do need it. So.
All right. Yeah. Any other discussion before I ask for a motion? Having said that, Representative Bentz, are you ready to make a motion?
Certainly. Chair, I move House Bill 2489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Is this a consent item? No, it's not. Representative Bentz will carry. But that will close the work session. We're going to have to reschedule the other public hearings rather than trying to cram them into
30 seconds. It just simply isn't fair to do that.
It's not fair.
So we'll repost those. And colleagues, thank you so much. These issues on things like the senior homestead issue is always complicated and always takes a lot of time. Thank you very much. With that, the committee's adjourned.
Yet I do think it.